Welcome back to the Special Ed Strategist podcast, where we bridge learning gaps and empower families to access the special education services they need. I am your host, Wendy Taylor, and our podcast is your go-to resource for special education, offering expert insights, inspiring stories, and actionable tips to help your child thrive. In this season, we'll dive deeper into the world of special education. So whether you're a parent, educator, or passionate advocate, join us in this journey. To make this season unforgettable, please like, listen, and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. Your support helps us reach more families and create a stronger, more inclusive future. So hit that subscribe button, join our community, and let's make season 3 a game changer. Thanks to listeners like you. Welcome to the show. We are in for an incredible treat. I am here with Ned Johnson. I'm going to have him do his introductions, and I'm excited to have our conversation about raising a self-driven child and what that means and how we can help our family. So welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Wendy. I'm looking forward to talking through this stuff with you. So for folks who don't know me, I have two hats that I wear. One, I'm a tutor geek. I run a company, president of a company called Prep Matters, where we help kids through school and into college, test prep and tutoring and college admissions and all that stuff. So I've spent way too much time with mostly juniors in high school during arguably one of the more stressful times of life, if not for them, then for their parents. And ideally learned a little bit along the way. And I moonlight as a parenting author, co-author with Bill Stickstrude of a couple of books. One, The Self-Driven Child, The Science and Sense of Giving Your Kids More Control of Your Lives that we'll talk about today. And we have a follow-up book called What Do You Say? Kind of a how-to scripts, how to talk with kids to build motivation, stress tolerance, and a happy home. And those things don't, it doesn't have to be an or, it can be all of those, folks.
I love it. Let's dive in. Can you explain why it's crucial for parents to promote a healthy sense of control in their children?
Yeah. I mean, so Bill and I got at this. We've been lecturing for a while about helping kids develop their own inner motivation. So not just having kids work hard, but want to work hard. And then we're palling around for a while and discovered we kind of like the way that one another thought. And Bill at one point said, it seems like we should maybe write some of this stuff down. Does it seem to you like there's an organizing principle? And I said, well, it feels to me like all the advice that we offer kids and their loving parents are things that improve a kid's sense of control. And we think about this in two domains. One is the subjective sense of autonomy, of competency, right? That I've got, I can handle this, right? And the brain state that supports it, meaning that when we're in our quote unquote right minds, the prefrontal cortex with all those executive functions, decision-making, problem solving, but also emotional and cognitive flexibility, that kind of runs the show and sort of will also manage the runaway stress response. And we think about the reason we find this is so important is for two big problems. One, what for us feels like disordered motivation, either kids who are obsessively driven, you know, perfectionistic and making themselves and possibly people around them crazy, or kids who figure, what's the point of even trying? And they've kind of already checked out on doing the hard work of, you know, of school and, you know, adolescents maybe generally. And then in addition to the motivational, of course, the stress problems that we see, I mean, the statistics that people probably know pretty well are just off the charts. And they were when we were starting to write this book in, you know, 2016 for anxiety, for depression, and it has only gotten worse in the last few years, dramatically worse. And it turns out that a low sense of control is the most stressful thing that anyone can experience. And so when we looked at the research, said, well, if a low sense of control is so darn stressful, then it's reasons to argue that anything that increases a sense of control will make people feel less stressed. And again, all the bad things that come from being overly stressed.
So how does fostering that sense of control influence a child's ability to cope with stress and navigating those challenges?
It's a good question. So the most interesting research that I go back to over and over is by a guy named Steve Mayer, who is probably most well known for the work on what's known as learned helplessness. He and Martin Seligman. And Mayer has this article called Learned Helplessness at 50. And it's worth people looking up and kind of what do we get right and what did we get wrong? And he said the big thing that we got wrong was this. It was not that these animals learned to be helpless and they'd sit there in a cage and just endure shock rather than walking out the door when they had the chance. Rather, he said, it was that they failed to learn a sense of control. And the really clever experiment he did he has two rats in a cage. Their tails are out the back. They're electrode, a mild electric shock. It's not life-threatening, but it sure is annoying and pretty stressful. And you can measure this in cortisol and all this kind of jazz. So he puts in the cage a wheel. And so rat A, when he spins the wheel, it attenuates, it stops the shock. And he's like, oh, this is a good thing. There's this massive activation in the left frontal lobe of the prefrontal cortex. This is the kind of sense of control part of the brain. And it dampens down the amygdala, the stress part of the brain. They do this over and over and over, and you get this wiring where something stressful happens. He doesn't freak out. He doesn't panic. He goes into coping mode. Turns out it's trans-situational, meaning this experience of being the shock with the wheel then generalizes in other places. They put him in a cage with big scary rat or loud music or whatever, and he doesn't freak out or hide in the corner. We see this brain activation where he goes into coping mode of, this is something I can handle. How do I handle it? And so when we know that the single strongest marker of neurological health, the single brain marker, is the strength of those connections between the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala. So what we want to do is have kids, all of us, have the opportunity with an adverse experience, not something like you're going to cut your arm off kind of thing, but it's stressful. It's not, and you feel that there's something that you can do to make it better or to tolerate, or even just telling yourself, I was strong enough to get through something that was hard. Here's the fun part. And parents want to pay attention to this. So rat B is also in this experiment. Rat B has a wheel that he spins and nothing happens. He ends up being this total basket case. He's just, everything is scary to him. So this is an ungood thing, as they would say in Catch 22. But the clever thing that Mayer and his colleagues did was do an experiment where he yoked the two rats, meaning that when rat A spun the wheel, he stopped the shock for himself and for rat B. Now, I'm sure that brother rat B was like, oh my gosh, thank you, super grateful to stop the shock. But he forever and also remained a basket case. They had the same experience, the same length of shock, but A had something where he felt a sense of control and B didn't. So when kids are in a hard situation and we do too much of the heavy lifting for them, and we deprive them of, when they feel that someone else is always saving them with their homework, their hard situations, their hard feelings, whatever, we're depriving them of the opportunity to feel that they can handle things for themselves. And we turn kids into perpetually being sort of the damsel in distress, looking to the sky for somebody to save them. And so this is just a tricky thing for all of us as parents, because we're wired to soothe our kids. We're wired to protect them. We want to help, but we want to do it. And I'm sure we're going to get into this, Wendy, but when we do it in the way that the kids feel support, but not like someone else is responsible for the outcome, we want kids to have as much experience solving problems for themselves, because we're literally wiring the brains. And Bill and I actually talked with Dr. Mayer, I don't know, early the start of the summer. And we were revisiting this and said, when we know that this is true, he said, a single experience with rodents anyway, he said, for adolescent rats, it appears that a single experience of an adverse experience where there's a sense of control, there's something they can do, seems to inoculate those rats against the effects of stress for the rest of their lives. And we said, well, golly, if that's the case, should we be like setting up experiments where we shock teenagers? And he sat back and said, it's a really good question.
Okay. Right?
You know, and the challenge is, of course, with all sorts of regulations, you probably are hard pressed to get permission to like shock people, 16-year-olds, but stick him in a cage with anyway.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that kind of leads to my next question, is at what point are we like handing over this baton, right? So we know that we can't just all of a sudden wake up on a Saturday morning and just roll that cart into our 16-year-old's bedroom and start shocking and see what happens. But at what point do we start holding over the baton of manager to consultant?
As early as you possibly can, right? You know, I mean, so when we think about it, a healthy sense of control, I mean, the opposite of it is I'm helpless, hopeless, powerless, overwhelmed, resigned to my life, and there's nothing I can do about it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's a researcher we're looking at who studied autonomy in 2-year-olds. These are foundational needs. If you're neurotypical, it's a foundational need. If you're neurodiverse, it's a typical need. If you're high IQ, if you're low IQ, remember that these studies, the first studies, these were done with animals, right? And so it's true everywhere. I mean, there's a reason we all reflect on our 2-year-olds, say, do it myself, right? I do it, not the boss of me, right? And that need for autonomy, of feeling in control, It starts, it's wired in brains from the get-go. So we don't put a four-year-old in charge of the household. We don't let them cross the street by themselves. You know, we kind of think about, well, Ross Green talks about the three baskets, right? What are things that are like life-threatening? And we don't let children make those decisions if they're really putting themselves in peril. There are things like clothing choices where nobody cares. My goodness, please don't fight about that. And then there are things that are in between where we want to kind of negotiate. And as parents, you know your kids. And you know when they need more support, when they need less support, you know, when some guidelines or some guardrails are important. But what we want to be thinking about is how can we let kids do things for themselves at the earliest possible age that feel developmentally appropriate. Keep in mind that when you first hand over the baton of anything with a kid, they're likely to do it quite imperfectly because they're learning. There's a story in the book. My wife teaches Latin at local school. She's a really good educator. And our son, who's the loveliest kid in the world, but pretty ADHD. And it was fifth grade, I think. And she's helping him with this, that, the other, and says, there was some assignment that not been handed in or not done. I can't remember. And she said, well, why didn't you hand it in? And he responded with precisely that energy. He said, because you didn't remind me. And I'm like, oh, okay, wait a second, buddy. We don't throw mom under the bus. That's just not a good idea. And, you know, and she's already done fifth grade. This is your chance, right? So, and I say to her, so listen, sweetheart, obviously that's got to be my side of the family, bad manners, I'm sure. But honestly, you can kind of understand why he says that, because she's organized enough executive functions that she could run her schedule, my son's schedule. You know, Wendy, if you need someone outsourced, she's great. And it's just that the challenge is that because kids do things and make messes and handle things poorly, and we can get so anxious about it, we jump in. And so I remember after we made this hard move towards really walking the walk of being a consultant, not letting my wife continue on, you know, being overly helpful, as I would describe it. And the first thing my son did was reward me with this. I was driving out of the office, driving out of my home out to my office. I see him walking home from school. Hey, kiddo. Hey, dad, how are you? I'm great. How are you? Oh, you had that test. Did you get the score back on your, I did. How'd it go? Not very well. Oh, tell me more. Yeah, I got a 52 on it. Out of 100? Yeah. Yeah, that's not very good. Do you know why? And so we had this long conversation, and I didn't blow my top because I don't do that. And I asked him, you know, kind of, why do you know? And I'm like, why'd you get a 52? I think I missed too many questions. Okay, wise guy, why do you miss too many questions? It takes about 5 minutes. We get to the end of it. You're going to love this. I think I studied the wrong chapter. Well, that's informative, right? Do you know why you studied the wrong chapter? Now we're having a very different conversation than you need to study more, because you could have studied more of the chapter 6 when you have a test in chapter 5. Wasn't going to make a darn bit of difference, right? And so it's just anything. Well, there's interesting. I was just interviewing Lenore Skenazy. If you know her, if folks don't know her, the author of Free Range Parenting and the Let Grow Project. And she had a really good piece in the Times first week of September about a simple solution to treat kids' anxiety, which is simply letting them do something that they want that might be a little bit scary, like letting your kid ride the subway or. And so there's so many things that we feel like it's our job to protect our kids against. A bad grade, you know, you know, someone not inviting them, you orchestrate things behind the scenes and talk to the mom. All these things where really they're children's problems. And we take them on as though they are ours. And so our job is to offer help, to offer support, but not to do things for kids, even though they're going to make a total mess of it, because we want them to have the experience making decisions for themselves. We want to, most of all, let them have the experience when they make a mistake to have an opportunity to fix that, because few things can be a greater source of confidence than I can try something, I can really go for it, I can swing hard, and if I screw it up, there's something that I can do to make it better. And too often we, as you know, as parents, as loving problem solvers, we jump in and solve problems. And we just don't want to solve problems for kids without, at the expense of letting them have the experience of solving those things for themselves.
All of this resonates with me, just even with my personal children. We have three boys, and then the families that I support and working with them in very similar vein of this, in terms of, you know, have them email their teacher and have them email them really early on, you know, second right. grade, third grade, as soon as they can, just if they have a question or they're worried about something or they're uncertain, because for that reason. It's slowly handing off that baton. And you're right, there's going to be some mess ups and it's not going to be perfect the first time. But, you know, we're raising adults here.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, we're going to have these really strong, confident adults that are ready to take on bigger problems. And a couple of things I tell our kids, they'll say, if they're telling me something, I'll say, do you want me to listen or do you want help with that?
I love it.
And I have found that a lot of times, just in our personal home, they'll say, I just wanted to tell you. Or I'll say, well, how could we solve this problem? And then they'll come up with solutions that I wouldn't necessarily have come up with, but that's good, bad, or indifferent, right? That doesn't matter because they're solving their own problems. And I feel like when our children, and I know you can speak to this as well, are younger, helping them clean up anything that went a little sideways on their attempt to solve a problem is way easier than helping our adult children. Those problems are going to get bigger and those complications are going to get bigger. And so it is way easier when they're tiny, tiny problems versus bigger, bigger problems. And I'm sure you have heard some of that as well.
You're 100% right. 100% right. You know, and there's a story and I forget which book it's in where Bill, you know, Bill's a clinical neuropsychologist. So he's talking with kids where learning isn't going that well. And he had two kids. One was a 9-year-old girl with ADHD and one was a 19-year-old boy with ADHD. And the girl would come home after school and dutifully do her work. She'd ask her mom's help. Her mom would sit with her and they'd get through the work and then she'd go off and play. The 19-year-old, Bill was saying, it was second semester of his first year of college. He'd flunked the first semester. The parents said, but he's really turned around. He's doing great. And Bill met with the kid and the kid's like, I haven't been to school in 6 weeks. And he said, this isn't an issue. This isn't an issue of brain development. I mean, the kid's 19, she's 9, but it's an accurate model of reality of who's responsible for what. And the challenge is, of course, we have as humans, as loving parents, we have something called, we talk about this in the second book, What Do You Say? We have what's called a writing reflex, meaning that if you tell me a problem, I tell you a problem, your kids or my kids, whatever, your brain immediately starts going, well, you could do this, you could do this, you could do this, you could do this. Yeah. Or a kid who's really spun up, oh, well, sweetheart, my gosh, it's only seventh grade. I didn't really like that teacher anyway. You know, you can go out for soccer, you can go play basketball, soccer. And we start trying to either offer solutions or to try to move kids through those hard feelings because their hard feelings are hard for us as well. The challenge is that both of those things feel invalidating. Well, Wendy, if you'd only done the thing that I just thought of, you wouldn't be in this pickle, you dope. Thanks, Ned. Right. Or it's not that big a deal, as though it's not right for you to feel what you feel. And so what we talk about, the first chapter of What Do You Say, is we just use validation, right? So if a kid comes home and he's bombed a test, you're like, so unfair, I studied like crazy and I can't, people question, they weren't even on the test, he was never going to be there. And it's, God, I wanted to do so well. As a parent, you're thinking, study, buddy, you watched 8 hours of football on Sunday. Are you kidding me? And then questions on the test. Mr. Johnson is like the most straightforward teacher in the history of anything, right? There's no way. And so you start thinking, or, well, obviously I'll help you study next time. We'll get you a tutor, right? Or it's only one quiz, you know, all of these things are true and useful, but oh, it's not a good first move.
Right.
So the art of empathy and validation is you just say, oh my gosh, you're really upset about this. I see what you're feeling. The validation, and this is the clever part, is you're simply acknowledging that a kid has a reason to feel this way. Now, if you're stuck on the fact that the kid's upset about a test that he didn't study for and he watched 8 hours of football, you can say something like this. Well, gosh, I'd be upset too if I felt like I'd studied really hard for a test and it hadn't gone well. Note that I'm validating his feelings, but I'm not agreeing with the facts.
Right.
And when we do this, a kid is much more likely to say, oh gosh, I'm so mad. I really wanted to do well on this. And if we take his side, there's a wonderful peaceful parenting person named Sarah Rosensweet says, when we see these natural consequences, we want to take our child's side emotionally, because if you say, well, then what will happen is the kid will come right around and blame us for the fact, well, why didn't you make me turn off the thing? Why didn't you make me study? As though it was our responsibility. So it's a tricky thing because, you know, as parents, we worry about if our kid bombs, you know, fifth grade math, that they're never going to go to Princeton or whatever, right? And we don't like to see them be upset because when they're upset, it makes us upset. I get it. Been there, done that. But we want to also, want to let kids have these hard feelings that are the, it makes sense that a kid is upset about something that's upsetting. And when we don't try to talk them out of that, we're also conveying to them that these feelings are appropriate. We're not depriving them of that natural consequence, right? And we're also saying that it's okay for you to have hard feelings, because a lot of the kids that Bill and I see, they tell us things and then they say, don't tell my parents because my dad will lose, my mom will be so upset. And when we overreact as parents or caregivers, it makes kids less likely to share problems with us. Yep. And because our raison d'etre, right, is to want to help kids solve problems, we can't help them solve problems that we don't know about. So I know it's a tall ask for folks to do this, but my only thing is this. If you have a kid who has not yet, when you get to high school, I can understand why you get more stressed. But goodness, if ever there's a time to bomb things, it's before you graduate eighth grade, because it's a total do-over. It's like if you're going to be an arsonist, I'm teasing, do those things before you turn 18, right? Because you're just stuck in juvie. I'm teasing, of course. But to your point, small problems when there's little or big problems when they're older.
Yeah. So that is a great point in terms of, we want to be this non-anxious presence mm-hmm. in our family. Mm-hmm. And not every parent is wired that way. So how can parents manage their own stress and anxiety effectively to create this calm and supportive environment for their children?
So there are a bunch of things. We talk about this in both books. And really quickly, the idea is simply that being a non-anxious presence means you're not over emotional, you're not overreactive. Because when you do that, we sort of add fuel to the fire, right? And we make things more intense. When we can be non-anxious and a calming presence, because we can act like a stress sponge and take that out of our kids, it makes it much more likely that their prefrontal cortex comes back online and solve the problem, just the way you talked about your child doing this. So a few things. One is, we always, always, always want to take the long view, right? Because our fears are really never about the present. It's about the idea that, oh my gosh, if Sally just broke up with my kiddo and now she has no friends. And then you're thinking, what does it feel like if she never has friends again? And that's terrifying. And we kind of go into crisis mode, right? Or a kid who's struggling like crazy in eighth grade, you think, oh my gosh, they're never going to be able to get a good job because they're never going to get this righted. Please remind yourself that your children want their lives to work out. It may look like all they want to do is play Xbox. I get it. But they want their lives to be successful. And kids will struggle and struggle and struggle. I'll tell you this. So my daughter was full school refusal for the last 3 months of eighth grade. All this anxiety, depression, all kinds of stuff going on, and had an evaluation, all this stuff. No one could figure out. We knew all this emotional stuff. 5 years later, she gets diagnosed with autism. She's this super high IQ, kind of typical bright masking girl that nobody knew how to look for 6 years ago. Now we do. We're learning how to do this. And so one of the things that I had to do and my wife had to do is, we have to take the long view and say, look, this is a really sharp kid. She's got a lot of great things. She's really fun. She's nice. She's creative. She's funny. Da, da, da. This all sucks. I mean, everything that you want to have going well in eighth grade, all of it was hard. But if if it's much easier, if you as a parent can believe that this is going to find, it's going to work itself out some way, it's much easier to add to that energy for kids to believe that it's going to work out. And then we just got to figure this out somehow and be patient. The second thing is to make it a really high value just to enjoy your kids. Because if you as a parent, you see your kids struggling, you see that they're upset, you're getting the umpteenth email from the school, you've got to make sure they're doing whatever. Schools have, I think, over the last 10 or 15 years, made parents come to believe that it's their responsibility for their kids to do their homework and to perform at an adequate level. And parents, responsible parents, have believed schools in that. And it cannot be your responsibility as a parent to make your kid do his homework. Because if you didn't want to, what are you going to do? You're going to duct tape him to a chair? You can't do it. And so it's a terrible idea to take on to take on something that's impossible for you to do. So we want to take the long view. We want to enjoy our kids, because when we get the umpteenth email home, we have this idea that if only we could fix this thing, then everything would be better and my kid would be more lovable. It is particularly when kids are struggling, when they are messing everything up, whatever that means to you, when they are cranky. Keep in mind, by the way, that for many children, boys especially, depression, anxiety can look like anger. And one of the hallmarks of depression is just irritability. And it is hard to love people who are prickly. But it's exactly in those moments when kids are at their most unlovable that they need most to be loved. The third thing that I'll say, and the last thing I'll say on this, is we as adults, we want to do everything we can to lower our own stress. And I know you've heard self-care 10,000 times, so I won't use that word. The way that I think about this is simply this. If the inflows of stress into your nervous system, your kid's nervous system, your family, your school, we'll say, I don't know, maybe the world in the last few years, are not met by healthy outflows of stress, you can predict every bad outcome you can imagine. Substance use, domestic abuse, truancy, fights, you know, violence, political, all of it. These are all predictable, maladaptive responses to stress. So if you feel yourself persistently impatient with your kid or angry or frustrated, it has to do with your reaction to your kid, not just your kid. And I'll throw in this really quick story, which I think is illustrative. So our son, I was actually doing the recording of the audiobook for What Do You Say? Came out of studio, my wife and I called her up, telling her about it. I said, oh, by the way, you have Matthew on the phone. Have you talked with Matthew? He was camp counselor in the summer and had all these migraines. We get him on the phone. We're talking how much ibuprofen is too much. Drops a word. Interesting. A few more sentences. Drops another word. Okay. Three more sentences. Utter gibberish. I think he's having a stroke. Vanessa, do me a favor. Call me on the line. Don't hang up or connect it through. Fast forward. Brain tumor. He's great now, but oh my. And my wife and I, they got life flighted, got the care up in Vermont, came down to Children's National, started all that stuff. He's great now. But my wife and I were out for dinner about 3 weeks into this. And she said, you know, it's the weirdest thing. I've had three people ask me, how are you so calm about all of this? Now, granted, we had a good team. They said that the prognosis was, you know, he had the right kind of brain tumor if you're going to have one. She said, but honestly, I think it's the meditation. So because Dr. William R. Stickshrute is 47 years now as a TM guy, transcendental meditation, I took this up about a decade ago, my wife 3 or 4 years, and her family are lovely people, but they are, what's the word, neurotic. They are not wired to be non-anxious. And she wasn't either. And she said, I really think it's that. And so my wife and I, it helps enormously that we have a really good marriage, but we also prioritize sleep and exercise and meditation because the world is a stressful place. And unless you want to hide from everything that's stressful, which means you're also probably missing all the fun challenges, you want to be able to go into high stress situations and then come back down to equilibrium. If you're constantly in a high state stress, you really can't do a good job or can't do as good a job of being a non-anxious presence. So again, if you find yourself perpetually frustrated or impatient with people, that is just another indication that your stress response is just wired a little bit hot. So think about the things that can help you just get stress out of your nervous system. You spend more time with your friends laughing. You find more time for exercise. You read, you meditate, whatever it is that you do. And this is not a plug for meditation, but not everybody needs it, but everybody needs something.
Yeah. And what a story for you for sharing that and how that really helped you understand and the resilience that came out of that experience. How does that then weave into radical downtime? You use it. Downtime is what came for, like,
yeah, no, I'm so glad you asked
it
that.
And let's see how that all weaves together.
So Bill has spent a lot of time lecturing about technology and the effects of technology on the brain. And one of the things that technology, there are two things that it does. One, everything with technology tends to, three things, make us busier. Email is supposed to save us time. Yeah, okay, sure. It speeds things up, right? Because everything that makes things go faster, it speeds things up. And two, we kind of have a split brain, right? You know, that whole idea, I'm hotter online, right? Well, people are thinking about themselves, you know, IRL in real life, and they're also thinking about themselves. And that what's called cognitive load is really hard. And so the more we feel rushed, the more we feel distracted, the more we feel have these divided minds, the harder it is on us. And so because all of us, you know, particularly anyone who's, you know, I'm 53, anyone who's over the age of 40 who can remember the world before the internet, right? we just know that it's so much more than it, so much more now than it used to be. And because I don't think we're putting that genie back in the bottle, our perspective on this is that to really recover, I'm not an anti-technologist, but in order to use that, and it's because all technology, it's highly stimulated, high dopamine activities. We need to balance that out with low dopamine activities. And so Bill has coined the phrase, I think, of radical digital downtime, where it used to be downtime is I'll go garden, I'll go golf or whatever. And he said, it's something where you're not actively doing anything. So it's daydreaming, you know, just lie in the backyard, look at the clouds. You remember how fun that is to do? Mind wandering, meditation. And then I'll talk about sleep in just a moment. These first three of mind wandering, daydreaming, and meditation, there's a part of the, it's not a part of the brain, a network in the brain called the default mode network. And it came out of some research, a woman named Mary Helen Imordino Yang, it's a lot of letters in there, where they were looking at brains and functional MRIs and kind of see what part lights up and blood flow and blah, 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 kind of what does what. And it was all predicated on the idea that if you're not actively, if you're in an MRI and you're not actively thinking about anything, that your brain activity will be like kind of flatline, pretty quiet. And it was completely the opposite. If you were not actively doing a cognitive task, you bam, your brain, it uses 70% of your brain's energy. And what the default mode network does, it's we reflect on the past, on our future, we think about ourselves, we think about our relationships. It's crucial for developing empathy. It's crucial for, importantly, especially important for teens, of developing a coherent sense of identity. Who am I? What do I want to be? How do I want to contribute to this world? And this really is the work of teenagers of figuring out their own identity. The paper, if anyone wants to look it up, NIH, is with the title, Rest is Not Idleness. And we have this tendency to make ourselves and our children so busy all the time. And then we all hop on our phones in addition, that there just isn't enough time. And so our perspective on this is we want to very consciously engage in these things that are totally offline, because it's so helpful for mental health. And such, I mean, it's just, it's incredibly powerful medicine. There's a there's also what's called forest bathing, Shinrin Yoku, Japanese term, where when people are in nature, it takes about 5 minutes and all of a sudden off their brains go in these ways that are wildly restorative. Even just looking at a picture of trees will invoke this. And then the last thing, sort of the ultimate of radical digital downtime, is sleep. And most people are so wildly underrested. And you should, I mean, a million things to know about sleep, but one of them is simply that when we are underrested, the amygdala is about 60% more reactive, because if all of our other cognitive functions of reaction time and verbal retrieval and everything, right? Attention, looks like ADHD when you're tired, everything goes to pieces. It makes sense that the amygdala, the threat detecting part of our brains, are spun up. And so this is why when we're tired, we feel like everyone's cutting us off in traffic. Everyone's, why is my spouse so annoying? My kids are rah, 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 rah. I was talking with this boy. He was a junior in high school, fabulous kid, really sharp, but also anxious and ADHD. And I was making the case for making sleep a higher priority. And I said, do you ever notice how, you know, everyone's giving you a hard time? You ever notice how when you're really tired that your mom's like just even more annoying than normal? Doesn't miss a beat. He goes, my God, I must be tired all the time. My hell, right? And you can see this in people and we can feel it in ourselves. So, you know, everyone knows about sleep, but I put this to people, try an experiment. If you can, try an experiment for 4 days where you get at least 8 hours of sleep and see if you notice a difference. And it's just profound. I mean, for people who have depression, most of them, when people have anxiety or depression, sleep insufficiency adds to that. So sleep deprivation is both a cause and a symptom of being anxious and depressed. It's really a thing. But for people who struggle with depression, when they were able to fix their sleep problems, for 50% of them, no more depression. No more depression. It's really a big deal.
How can parents then help facilitate these activities? I mean, sleep, I got that. But as you mentioned, families seem so overscheduled. And I have the answer, what I think, but you as the professional, how do you say that? How do you help parents kind of get online with this to help facilitate this understanding of the value of downtime, that in a world that's so focused on constant productivity?
It's a good question. I mean, I think there's sort of three things. One is we really need to question what is it that we're doing and how are we spending our time? Because there's a tendency to commit to 1,000 different activities and then sleep with whatever time is left over. And the model that I want to talk with kids about is in personal finance. If you want to save for a vacation or a house or a college education or a car or whatever it happens to be, the idea of you pay yourself first. So at the beginning of the month, you set aside $50, $500, whatever it is, and put that in a separate account. And then you spend on the rest of your life. Because when people try, say, at the end of the month, I'll put away, they end up with nothing left. So we pay ourselves first. So there are 168 hours in a week. Okay. So if as an adult, you need to be between 7 and 9 hours of sleep. Okay. So 49 to 63 hours, right? And you figure out how am I going to get those hours? And then how am I going to spend the rest of that time? The second thing is we want to very purposely schedule downtime. And so nobody touches any digital device before noon on Sunday. We're just going to have pancakes and we're going to read the comics and we're going to go for a walk and we'll throw tennis balls to the dog or whatever your family ritual is, right? So scheduling those times out, and so often it's curious, so often people see these people who are wildly, oh my gosh, they have such self-control. A lot of what looks like really good self-control are just really good habits, right? And so you build this structure into, you know, we always have, and you certain times of the week, of the day where it's a non-tech time, I go out with my wife and we go on a walk, we leave our cell phones home. You know, oh my gosh, what if you get lost? Do you think there's anyone else you might pass on the street who has a map? Is that possible? I mean, give me a break. And then the third thing, we want to make those family values, right? We want to make there was a study that was done in England where it was something like 60%. This was a handful of years ago. 60% of parents thought their kids were on their phones too much. 70% of kids thought their parents were on their phones too much. Right. So we want to make this, we want to schedule it. We want to make it a family value. And last of all, we want to model it because it's a foundational rule of personal effectiveness that I cannot credibly ask of someone else things that I'm not prepared to do myself. And I will tell you that the only thing I continually talked about with my kids was sleep. And it started when they were like 3 or 2. And my wife and I would go out to, you know, we'd go to someone's house and the kids would be out, we get them in bed really late. And as I tuck them in and gave them a kiss, I would simply say to them, hey, do me a favor tomorrow. When you think about it, try to be a little bit more patient with yourself and with other people. Because when you're tired, things are just going to bug you more. So just keep that in mind. And it was like a drip feed. And I can remember being like, my kids were like 8 or whatever. And whatever I'd done, I had not gotten, I don't know. I was in a foul mood. I was a little cranky and I'm usually not cranky. And one of my kids turned and said, Daddy, did you get enough sleep last night? It was amazing, right? So they had anchored sleep to their own happiness and sleep to their own behavior. And the reality, of course, is you can't make kids sleep. You sure don't want to get in a fight with a teenager about technology because it'll be very humbling for you. And so all of these things we talk about, how do we work in a collaborative way? But it really does start with, we want to think of these, we want to treat these as family goals, right? I mean, Bill was talking with this family and said, our kid is so, I mean, he's really struggling to sleep. It's just a mess. Well, how do you sleep? Oh, I'm a terrible insomniac, right?
There you go. There you go. Yeah. And I think it's incredibly important. What would you say to a parent that's listening that this is really resonating with them, but they have the older children? So mm-hmm. Now they're thinking, all right, Ned, I didn't do this when they were little. How right. can I start setting up this structure of family goals and downtime and such?
Well, with anything like family goals, I mean, you can say, first of all, we never have these conversations when people are upset. We don't do it when they're busy. We want to get their full attention. Say, hey, listen, you know, I've been thinking a little bit about how we struggle, how we schedule our weekends. And I'd love to talk to you on Sunday about it. We can just find a half an hour to talk about it. And you want to be careful you don't monologue. I mean, I'm a big fan of family meetings. And so I've been thinking about it. You know, I feel like we're just always so busy and on the go. And honestly, for me, some of the most fun times are when we don't feel rushed and we all make pancakes together or we play a board game. And I know that you're a teenager, so you want to spend your time with your friends more and you've got all these things you got to do. But, you know, I'd love to have your thoughts. Is there a way that we can carve out a few times when we're just you know, kind of doing stuff with each other, because I love you to pieces. And it also occurs to me, I mean, golly, you're in 3 years, you're going to go off to college, and that's kind of going to be it. And put it to them. And so you don't try to put your thumb on the scale, because one of the things that happens when we argue strongly for one thing, kids are going to, we talk about this in The Language and Silence of Change, the chapter 7 in our second book, the kids are going to be ambivalent. So at the same time that they actually do want, the literature shows, they do want to spend quality time with their families, with their parents. And but they also want to go off and watch the football game and be with their friends, which is developmentally appropriate. So they're a little bit stuck. And so if we put it to them in a very open way, you know, and you may not have any thoughts on that, but maybe we can talk about this next week and let them think on it. They're much more, you're much, much more likely to get buy-in than when you enforce some family rule. When we think, you know, with radical downtime, things like meditation, I'm always getting, you know, most teenagers don't want to meditate because they feel like it's weird because other kids aren't doing it. So this tends to go best when there's schools that make it a practice. But you can offer, you know, for both of my kids, I said, would you like to learn meditation? And they said, sure. And so they both went through it. My daughter has not persisted with it. My son goes back and forth with it. And he's really grateful that he has this as a tool in his toolbox. Would it be better if he did it all the time? Sure it would. But I'm sure, heck, you can't make a person meditate anymore than you can make an infant fall asleep. It just can't be done, right? So just always offering these things. In terms of sleep, and this one is always hard because particularly for kids who are really academic, gosh, help them if they're perfectionistic, they know that they want more sleep, but they're also afraid that if they don't stay up late enough doing the stuff that some terrible loss will occur to them when it comes to college admissions. So our advice on this is wait until your kid is upset or tired or whatever. And you just very empathetically say, wow, you look like you really have been working hard. And I know what it feels like to be so tired. That's got to be hard. You know, if you want to, I'd love to talk with you about some ideas that maybe they can help so you can keep being successful the way you're committed to, but that also allows you to get a little bit more sleep, and leave it there. Because you need to invite them into those conversations. When you try to force it on them, they will, because they're ambivalent, all the reasons you say yes, they'll say I'll think of all the reasons why, yeah, but, and why it won't work. But I'll say that there's a chapter in The Hard Ones, talking with kids about sleep and technology, because it is hard. And sleep and technology are often inextricably linked. What I tend to do with kids that, you know, I work with, again, mostly juniors in high school, when I see an opportunity, when the sleep is some issue, I'll ask them, so Austin, what time do you go to bed at night? What time do you normally get into bed? And they'll say 11 o'clock. And I said, well, what time do you have to be up for school? And they say like 6:15. I said, okay. Seven. I said, does that make you tired? I'm like, yeah, but it, you know, it's all right. And so then I'll put to them, and Bill and I work really hard to use this tentative language and said, if you wanted to, and I don't know that you want to, but if you did want to, would it be possible to get in bed by like 10:30 instead of 11 or 11:15? And sometimes they'll say, no, it's just not possible because I have so much homework. Well, then we can have a conversation about, are there ways to be more efficient with their work or getting things done during the school time? Or I'll just let it go and wait for them to come back around. And they'll say, yeah, I probably could. And then what I've often done is said, I'd love for you to try an experiment. Keep in mind, I'm a test prep geek, so I'm interested in getting sleep so they get the score so I look like I know what I'm doing. And so, you know, say, so let's try this. So you'll love this story. This was so wackadoodle. So I had this kid I was working with. Her older brother had the bad manners to go to Princeton. He was a baseball recruit. She was not going to get to Princeton because she didn't play baseball. And she was a good student, but really, really, really wanted to go to, what was it, UVA or something. I guess it was UVA, where she had a deep family connection. So we're prepping for the ACT for the umpteenth time. And she would practice at this level at 32 or 3 or whatever, this is a bunch of years ago, and then perform it at 29. That is frustrating for her, for me. Her mom's looking at me like, you do know what you're doing? On and on we go. She's very anxious. And I know this. And we know that anxiety undercuts performance with kids who are bright more than it undercuts performance who are not bright, because it's that working memory piece that goes sideways. So I'm seeing her on a Sunday. She's taking the test the following Saturday. So I'm making the case for what to do for, you know, study and review this week and blah, 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 and for sleep. And her face falls. And I'm like, what? And she's like, oh, my friends. And she was sort of one of those people who was felt herself on the periphery of her friend group. So she just didn't want to miss things because it made her anxious. I get it. And she went to, and I said, what if your mom paid you? And she said, what? And I said, I know you don't. I said, I know you, because you don't want to miss this stuff. It's important to you. Of course your friends, you're a teenage girl. Of course your friends are important. You have great friends. And I also know you put so much work into this. And I know the signs. You're going to do better on Saturday if you're more well-rested. But I know that it's hard for you. And so what if your mom sort of paid you? What if she, you know, bribed you? Would that help? And I don't want to do, I don't do these things in a coercive way. And she's, well, my mom wouldn't pay me. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. They paid me a fortune. Okay, whatever. I said, what if I paid you? She said, what? I said, what if I just paid you? It gave you incentive. If you want to, you don't have to, but it gave you incentive to go. You wouldn't pay me. Oh, I would. No, you wouldn't. Try me. Really? So I go out and repeat the whole thing to her mom. I said, if she hands her phone in to you by 9:45 and she's in bed by 10 or 10:15 rather than 11 o'clock, I'll give her $20. She said, for the week? I said, I'll give you $20 a night. No, you won't. Yes, you will. No, you won't. Try me. Shows up on Friday. I peel off five $20 bills. She's just looking at me like, really? Goes and takes the test, gets her 33, because rested brains work better than tired brains. But I couldn't make her do it. I can make the case and say, if you want to, I'd be willing to give you this incentive. So there's a lot to, it's a really fun chapter. It's hard to overstate how much test prep money has been paid to me that I turn around and then talk with kids, not at them ideally, talk with them about sleep, because it just makes such a difference. And for anyone who's listening, for any school, this is my current rant, for any school that talks about science-based education that starts school at 8 o'clock, you're lying. You either don't know or you don't care, but you're lying. If you're starting school for high school kids, this is for every private school that's out there, that's starting school at 8 o'clock, when you can, because it's your school, you can change it. You don't have to do this thing for the county, that you're starting school at 8 o'clock, you're ignoring the science and you don't really care about how brains develop. Okay, that will not get me invited to talk at any of these schools. Anyway, it makes me so upset.
You're first. Well, I do love how you have phrased everything. You are definitely passionate and live by your words of framing things as that consultant role versus a manager. And when you mentioned quickly about elite colleges, it made me think about, what is your advice about talking the long view and not pressuring kids to aim exclusively for elite colleges?
Well, the thing that's interesting, Well, the thing that's interesting is, at this point, parents don't have to talk to kids about pressure elite schools. It's already in the soup. They already feel like they have to do it all the time. So one of the more interesting challenges for parents is a kid who seems perfectionistically bent, who believes if she doesn't go to Ivy League school, she can't have a successful life. And parents like, oh, come on, kiddo. Like, I went to, you know, Wisconsin, and it's a great school. I mean, it's obviously a lot harder to get to now. And there's just, it's just not true. And the problem is, when people get real, when they're really stressed in their thinking, you can't talk them out of that by rational thought. So Bill and I actually were given a talk over the, if you know the Study Pro folks, you know, and this mom was asking about just this, and I was leading in with all these facts that I know. And Bill said, well, he said, respectfully, I don't know that you can talk her out of this. And he said, what I would say to her is, look, I'm not going to try to talk you out of that. If you want to believe that you have to go to a top 20 school in order to have a successful life, I'm not going to talk you out of that. I see it pretty differently. And I'm happy to share with my thoughts if you want. That, because it's not being pressed, it changes their thinking. The second thing is, you can say something like, wow, it must be hard to feel like you have to be perfect all the time in order to get into a school, because everyone else is trying to go to the same schools. That has got to be hard. And what that does is invite kids like, oh my God, you have no idea. I'm working like 18,000 hours a week, and everything I do, I can only get a 94, and these get a 97. I don't understand. And on and on and on it goes. Because so often kids, they feel all this pressure, but they feel like they can't talk about it. And I'll say that, you know, if a kid is hell-bent on going to Princeton, I always pick on Princeton because with students, I say, because I could not go to Princeton because I can't live for 4 years in Orange. People don't know, I will look like I'm dead. I'm like the whitest person in America. I'm like, I just can't do it. I can't go to Clemson. I can't go to Syracuse, UVA, forget it. So, but if you want to go to Princeton, that's fantastic, right? But most mental health is changing thinking from I have to I want to. And so if you want to go to Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Stanford, Williams, Amherst, great. I am all about that. But there is simply no evidence that you have to go to a highly rejective college. I love that term, my friend Akhil Bello, that you have to go to a highly rejective college to have a successful life. It's just, there's abundant research. And so what I want to help kids do is simply for them to know that there's a place for them in this world. There's a path for them to build lives that they want. right? And if that's through a highly, highly, highly rejective, selective, whatever you want to call it, college, great. And if it's not, great. Because one of the things that, you know, we see increasingly, when you look at places like Yale, 60% of kids there have anxiety or major depression. And it's the same chronic pressure that so many young people put themselves under to achieve at the highest possible level that leads them to terrible, terrible outcomes. I've lectured a bunch of times I won't mention the name of the community outside of Phoenix, Arizona, that's like the suicide capital of America. And the day that I was there, this is amazing. It's terrible. The day that I was there, they'd had the 55th suicide in 5 years. I get a call, and this is a couple of years ago. It just keeps going and going and going. I get a call from this friend of mine, Katie McPherson, who's a brilliant suicide prevention specialist. And they had 3 kids die by suicide in 9 days. And she said, and she just lost her mind. She said, I went right to the mayor, I went to the superintendent of schools, and can we do something about this? Here's where it gets terrible. Complicated school system in Arizona. I won't go into the details of it now, but it makes the public schools there be sort of frozen, that they're afraid that they make a wrong step. And they said, well, if we do a suicide prevention program, we have to admit that there's the problem with suicides. And that's kind of not part of our branding. And people want to live in this community because they think the schools are really good. And if they think kids are dying, they don't want to think the schools are good. And then people don't want to live here, you know, the real estate values will go down. And I said, wait a second, wait. You're going to pin the real estate values on excessive pressure to excel on kids? And so I made this really angry TikTok. So just so I'm clear, how many student deaths are acceptable to keep up the real estate rates? Right, to keep up the real estate values. And so it's challenging. I mean, I would love for people, if you get, pick up the book, it's for, you know, the worst ways to spend $14, give it to the Bezos guy and read the chapter on talking with kids about the pursuit of happiness and kind of what we know goes into happiness. Now, a lot of people say, it's not my goal to make my kid happy. Again, don't mistake pleasure for happiness. Happiness, pleasure is rooted in dopamine, right? Video games and chocolate chip cookies and whatever, where happiness is rooted in serotonin. And among other things, we know that people are happy. There's this great thing where they studied baseball cards, rookie baseball cards, and they looked at the pictures of folks. And some had kind of like a blank expression. Some had kind of a mild smile. Some people had these radiant things like, I can't believe I'm in the major league smile. And the people who had these broad, wide open smiles on average lived, I think it was 7 years more than the people with the flat expressions. 7 years. Because happiness is good for everything. So, yeah.
So then how do you help with parents in terms of, you know, we have students that are late bloomers or just taking a different path in life. Mm-hmm. How can we highlight the value of taking a longer term approach to parenting and personal development?
Well, it's a great question. So 2 things come to mind. One, we have a chapter in the book, I think it's chapter 4, about motivation. And there's a guy named Reed Larson who looked at how is it that teenagers become intrinsically motivated. And he said, it's not by dutifully doing their homework. It's by what he described as the passionate pursuit of pastimes. So when you're deeply engaged in you know, shooting with your opposite hand on lacrosse or rock climbing, or you do small engine repair or art or whatever, coding, any of this stuff, where you work harder and harder to get better and better at something that matters to you. And back to this conversation with Lenore Skenazy, where they gave the kids this opportunity to do something that they wanted, and it was as effective as CBT. It was a very small sample, but as effective as cognitive behavioral therapy, by the way, with anxiety. They try to have kids make a kind of a stress ladder and incrementally do things that are stressful to rewire them for stress tolerance. Oftentimes, though, it's a lot of kind of coaxing and coaching and sometimes extrinsic rewards to get kids to take on the things that they want. What she did with this Let Go program is they had kids do things that they wanted that had all these stressors involved in them, but the kids didn't know it. They didn't know what they're going to be facing. Parents were trying to keep kids from doing this because, oh my gosh and oh my golly. Think about if you're an artist and you're making a picture, right? My son the other day was carving something with wood, and he was carving and carving and carving and carving and carving. And then this very significant piece snapped off. Holy cow, was he so frustrated. 2.5 hours in, and there you go. You make a picture and then you overpaint and you're like, oh, I'm so frustrated. And you want to tear the whole thing up. You're fit to be tied. That is fantastic. Because a person is working really hard on this painting and she cares about it. And then she has the distress and she has to talk herself down or do it again and engage with it. And so that from our perspective, for kids who are not academically, you know, inclined yet, so long as they're working hard to get better at something that matters to them, don't worry about it, because that's, they're wiring their brains in ways that they can turn that attention and that focus when they finally come around to something academic that matters to them. We have this idea, if we don't have kids working hard when they're 6 or 16, that they're never going to do it. And it's just hogwash. The second part to it is that the more we try to tell kids, you have to, you have to, you have to. For a lot of kids for whom learning is hard, who feel like they're never going to do well or match up or catch up, this is important. The major manifestation of anxiety is avoidance. And so the more we tell kids how incredibly important is the thing that they're sucking at, they don't want to work harder. They don't want to do, they can do everything they can to escape and get away from it. Or they'll just cheat to get the grades, to get their, help their parents be less anxious and get them off their backs. And when we can say, and this goes back to being a non-anxious person, say, look, you know, you're a bright kid. You know, I'm confident you can do this stuff. And this may be hard for you. If you need some help, I'm happy to help. If you want me to get a tutor, I'll get you a tutor. I'll tell you the story about my son. So he's ADHD. He's a bright kid and he's ADHD. And for him, writing papers was just, it was death because he would procrastinate. He also then developed a little OCD. So that's a terrible combination. And he was struggling. The school he attended had these really big research papers, really hard. And I was watching this all the way through ninth grade, all the way through 10th grade. We get to junior and I sort of can't handle it anymore because it was so painful to watch. And I said, listen, would you like to work with a writing tutor to help you sort of stay on top of this stuff? And I said, well, what would be involved in that? And I sort of tell him what I think. I run a tutoring company, folks. So I know people, right? But I was never going to force this stuff. And he said, let's give it a try. So, Kate's amazing. Let's have you work with Kate. And so they're doing this stuff and they have all these milestones they're supposed to be working on. And maybe the third week in, he said, Dad, I feel like I'm wasting your money and Kate's time. I said, what do you mean? Well, we have all the stuff we're supposed to do. And I end up doing it like at 10:30 on Sunday, right before I go and meet with Kate. And then we sit there and like, what are we going to sort of even talk about? And I said, respectfully, I think it's working beautifully. Because you love Kate and she loves you and you don't want to show up empty handed. And so you get your homework done as much for her, where if you didn't have her, I think you would probably have blown that off and blown off and then it all would have piled up and it would have been a last minute thing. Do you think that's right? Yeah, I think that is right. And so for kids who struggle with learning with ADHD or, you know, autism or dyslexia or anything where learning is hard, they naturally are going to want to avoid the things that are hard, because who wants to do things that are hard? And so kids who struggle with learning, they need more support. And we go back right to that chapter about, I love you too much to fight with about your homework, and you offer help and you offer advice. But for kids whose parents really worried that they're never going to be on a path towards college, you know, or towards a successful life, please know. Oh, here's the last chapter in The Self-Driven Child is called Alternate Routes. Alternate Routes. And it's all the different ways that people, you know, have, you know, they went to three different colleges before they finally made it. The story that Bill's been telling of late, he has a friend who had a kid who was really not academic. I think he had a 1.7 GPA in high school. That doesn't give you a lot of college choices. So he joined the Navy. He was tested. He tested in the SEALs, you know, which is the thing to do. Turned out he had some undiagnosed heart problems, so he couldn't be in the SEALs. So he gets commissioned onto some boat somewhere. And so he's off doing all this work. And the admiral, you know, sees that this guy is really sharp, gives him more and more responsibility. He does it well because he's bright and he's capable. Says to somebody, you know, did you ever think about college? Because, man, you're really good at this stuff. So he takes the ACT on a boat someplace in the middle of wherever it was, gets like a nearly perfect score on this. He's now in his third year at Harvard. Right. And so if you just go back to this idea that life is not a video game, there is no do-over. And kids, this is important, want their lives to work. It may not be the life that you as a parent want them to have. It may be in a way that makes you a little crazy. I get it. Been there, done that. But please know that your kids, I believe the kids have brains in their heads and they want their lives to work out.
That's a great way to kind of wrap up this whole conversation. Is there anything that I did not know enough about to ask that should have?
I'll run through really quickly, just again, the second chapter, the parent is a consultant. And there's simply three implications. One, you offer help and you offer advice. Because when you offer help and you offer advice, if it doesn't feel forced, kids are so much more likely to think about it. Two, we want to let kids at the youngest possible age make choices for about their own lives. But we want them to be informed choices, right? We don't want them to be impulsive. But like, let's talk through this. With my daughter, who's wildly brighter than I am, but also very rigid, you know, I use this line that Bill introduced me to. He said, it's your call. Listen, kiddo, it's going to be your call. Whatever you want to do, that whatever you decide to do, that's what we're going to do. But I really like to talk through this. And when I took force off the table, it made it so much more likely that she would hear my perspective. And she didn't always land where I wanted her to land, but it worked so much better when I would try to talk her into things. And then so offer help, offer advice, let kids make their own decisions, because we want them to have a lot of experience doing that before they go off to college with a suitcase full of our money. And the last thing again is please do everything you can to let your kids solve their own problems. Bill has this list of questions when he talks with folks. And the first question is, one, whose life is it? Two, whose problem is it? Three, whose responsibility is it? And again, in the last 20 years, parenting has changed in so much qualitatively that we've come to believe that so much of what is children's lives, children's responsibilities, and children's problems are our problems, and it's our job to solve those and for them. But when we do that, we're missing this opportunity. And I'll end with this, that Bill and I talk over and over whenever we lecture, that the most important outcome of high school and adolescence is not where you go to college. And I say this as a test prep geek, is not where you go to college, but it's in developing the brain that you carry into adulthood. And if we can just hold to that, because I mean, how many people are listening to this? I always, when I lecture, I say, raise your hand if you did not go to an Ivy League university, right? And it's always like almost everybody in there. And I'm not picking on people who went to Ivy, because these are wonderful places of education. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with them. But we simply have to, as a society, do a better job, you know, in helping kids understand that there are many paths to building successful lives.
That's right. That's right. So I have one final passing question that I ask all of my guests. If you had one tip for parents to put on a billboard, what would it be and why?
Well, I'll tell you this story. So I had a kid who, older sister, very academic, went to Georgetown, blah, blah, blah. Younger brother, harder, anxiety, ADHD, all sorts of challenges. Was talking with him early on and parents. And basically what he was doing was avoiding his homework and then, you know, until his parents went to bed and then staying up all night. So you can just incredibly dysregulated. So I get this email from dad who says, I've decided to withdraw all support to my son. Do you have time to talk? That's an email. I'd be happy to talk, but if I may, what kind of support have you been giving to him? Well, I remind him that he has to do his homework. Okay. Is it working? No. How many times a day do you remind him to do his homework? I don't know, maybe 4 or 5. It's my wife who's on him all the time. Okay, so this kid gets home at 4 o'clock. He goes to bed you go to bed at 10. So if you're 4 or 5 times and she's more than that, so maybe like 15. So basically every 20 minutes, someone's asking, have you done your homework? Have you done your homework? I wouldn't want to do it either. And I said, may I offer a suggestion? He says, okay. I said, when he comes home, ask, do you have a plan for your homework? Oh, I do. And then I make him show me a plan. I said, don't make him show you the plan. Simply ask. So this is like a flow chart. Do you have a plan? If he says yes, say great. If he does not, so would you like help making a plan? Yes or no? You just follow the decision tree. Once he says he has a plan, ask, is there anything on that plan I can be helpful with that won't drive you crazy? If he says yes, follow through. If he says no, let it go. And then say, because you're going to want to, because you will, ask, is it okay if I circle back in a couple hours and just check in on you and see if there's anything you need help with? That's it. Try it. Just try it. I get an email that night. Maybe it was your advice or maybe just changed, but I just had the best conversation with my son possibly ever. And I'm like, because you changed the energy. Because you change the energy, you know? And so it's so hard. I don't want to give any parent a hard time, because we know that a low sense of control is so stressful. And so because you love your kids so much and you want only good things for them, when you see things careening into a ditch, of course you try to exert more control. When your kid is struggling, when they're anxious, when they're depressed, of course you do. And it is simply paradoxical. It's a counterintuitive to people to think that when my kid is struggling, what I actually need to do is give them more control. Because when we do this, it lowers their anxiety, increases their motivation. It brings all those executive function problem solving things like you're describing with your child back online. And we're giving kids the sense that I have confidence in your ability to make your life go in the direction that you want it to go. So if you feel like you've been fighting with your kid, try that. Do you have a plan? Can I help? Anything I can do to help? Is it okay if I check in later? Because that way you're respectfully saying, I'm offering all the help that you could want and I won't force it on you. So I'd give that one a try. I was pretty proud of that one. And that dad.
And the response.
Oh yeah. Yeah. He did great. You know, and this kid, I mean, he wants to follow his sister. And he has gone from like a 23 on the ACT to a 33.
Nice.
And this is this is some stuff that we learn, but so much of it is how do we put kids in position so that their brains work as well as they can? And when kids struggle with motivation and they struggle with fear and anxiety and avoidance, we don't get as good outcomes. When we are less stressful, when we are less controlling, their brains work better and we're more likely to get to the place that we so want them to be.
I am so thankful for us and having this conversation. I know that it's going to reach a lot of families. So I am appreciative of you taking the time out of your day to chat. And I hope folks go out, purchase your book and reach out, books plural, to you guys. And this is really going to help a lot. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. And I show maybe if you put on the, if there's a page connected to it, I made this TikTok called The Last Minute Kid. And it goes through the neuroscience of procrastination. And I met Monica Werner, if you know, a great, great local therapist. And she said, I show this to my families all the time. And it was the kids say extra. It was just completely bonkers. And it's like, it went super viral. So super fun. And so for parents who have an ADHD kid and can't understand, why would they do that the last possible minute? I have the video for you.
Send me the link. We will certainly
send you the link.
We will attach it. Yeah. That's awesome. I cannot wait. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. You know, it's for all of us. I mean, you know, the work that you do as well. There's nothing more enjoyable than helping kids but perhaps helping people or helping kids. So for all those parents who are out there, I hope that some of what I've shared is helpful for you because you love your kids and you want them to be successful in the exact same ways that they also want to have successful lives. So I hope this helps.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you again for tuning into another episode of the Special Ed Strategist podcast. I hope you found today's podcast insightful and valuable. Before we sign off, remember to show your support by liking, sharing, and subscribing to our podcast. Your engagement helps us continue our mission of empowering families and bridging learning gaps in special education. Don't forget to spread the word about the Special Ed Strategist podcast with your friends, family, and colleagues who may benefit from our content. Together, we can make a difference in the lives of children with special needs. I am your host, Wendy Taylor, and I can't wait to bring you more inspiring content in the future. Until next time, stay informed, stay inspired, and keep making a positive impact. Goodbye for now.